I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And we have the podcast Office Ladies. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories and lots of laughs.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This is WTIC's Computer Talk with Tab, hosted by Eric Semmel and Dennis Halnan of Tab Computer Systems. Interact with Eric and Dennis by phone at 860-522-9842 or email them in the studio at gethelp@tabinc.com. Get help anytime at computertalkwithtab.com. Now, here are Eric and Dennis on WTIC News Talk 1080.
And good morning. This is Computer Talk with Tab. I'm Eric.
And I'm Dennis.
And we're going to be here until 11 o'clock. And we are lucky enough to have a former commissioner of Pura on the line, Michael Caron. You there, Michael?
I am here, Eric. Good to see you.
Oh, good.
Nice to hear you.
Yeah, it's all the same thing. Theater of the mind, you're seeing us in your head. We're happy to have you on the program. Michael, you have been a commissioner of Pura for how long?
It ended up about 13 and a half years.
13 and a half years.
All right.
Regulating electricity. So having you on this program, you and I have talked in the past. I've always wanted to have you talking about, you know, either internet or electricity or what have you. But electricity obviously is big in the news. And we chatted a little bit yesterday about what's going on with electricity. And I'm like, you need to come on and explain to the folks a little bit of how electricity works in Connecticut, because I think we don't understand it. We clearly don't understand it. And having you on to explain, if you could explain Pura's role, like how is it, what is the purpose of Pura? How, what do you guys do to actually get us the rates that we end up with?
Okay, rather broad question.
Yes, sir.
The regulator throughout the country essentially stands in for lack of a competitor. So utilities, by the nature of their investments and the way they're structured, are known as a natural monopoly.
Yep.
And the services are critical and have been since the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
It was recognized that nothing could really replace electricity. Steam power just went away as electricity became more and more efficient and cheaper and cheaper.
Yep.
And one of the ironies of the fact that they're a monopoly is that it was the best way that they found to reduce costs and increase customers, thereby increasing revenues, but also spreading the fixed costs of generating electricity in the first place and distributing it over a broader group of customers.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one of those ironies why they ended up becoming a monopoly.
Yep. I want to talk about that further at some point, but go ahead.
But anyway, so the regulator is there to monitor the costs, the investments and the costs of the utility as they run their business as a prudent, reasonable person would. It's a reason court in legal terms that the reasonable man principle.
All right.
So we're not there to micromanage them, but we're more like the Monday morning quarterback. So utilities make investments on their own to raising money in the stock market, to shares of their companies, and through bonds of investors.
Now, as far as the regulator, Michael, I mean, you also are interpreting statutory laws created by our legislature, right? You're not deciding what's reasonable or not. The legislature has said, here's the framework that you have to follow, correct?
Yeah, there's a framework, but we do have broad discretion through the statutes on determining what our prudent measures, but that's also determined in statute as well, that there are three conditions to show prudency. And again, it's what would a reasonable person do in the same circumstances. And so as we go through these rate applications when they come to us, they're literally almost a foot high in terms of the application. And then constant series of what do we call formal interrogatories, which the authority sends out, the Office of Consumer Counsel sends out, which the Office of Consumer Counsel in Connecticut is the official ratepayer advocate. Other stakeholders that are made parties to the docket or the rate case being the Attorney General's office and the Commissioner of DEEP and any other people who have an interest in the rate case. So we analyze all the costs and investments that the utility has made over the course of previous 4 or 5 years and determine if those investments are equipment or other items used to run the business. They're used and useful. They were prudently incurred, meaning they made an effort, a good faith effort to find the least cost and to manage the franchise as any normal, prudent, reasonable person would. And if those conditions are met, we approve the cost that they had already spent for recovery from the ratepayer in the form of generally increased rates from the previous rate case, generally 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years earlier.
Okay. Now, you talked about prudent, you talked about ratepayers, you talked about reasonable, which all seems nice, right? All seems logical, right, to us sitting here listening. Oh, okay, that's how rates are set. But prudent, reasonable, when it comes to the green energy that we're paying 4 and 5 times the cost for per kilowatt hour because of mandates by the legislature, who deems that as prudent or reasonable? For me, I would deem that unreasonable and not that prudent, considering our electric bills. So when you deal with this, I assume you're dealing with prudent and reasonable as it goes to a cost for electricity that is many, many more times expensive. You're saying, well, at least it's not 7 times, it's only 5 times more expensive, and that's prudent and reasonable?
That's not how it would be analyzed. I mean, it's based on what the legislature determines will be in the public interest, and therefore the state shall procure certain percentage of its electricity in the form of renewable power, i.e. solar panels, wind, hydroelectric. So the legislature has determined that that's in the public interest. So consequently, if the state has procured, has a responsibility to actually buy and create contracts with generators of windmills, solar panels, hydroelectric plants.
Right.
And Connecticut has a renewable portfolio standard known as the RPS, that certain percentage of our electricity mix will be renewable or carbon free.
Right.
Off the top of my head, it's something like, I want to say 16 or 18% at this point.
18%, right? So it's a small percentage, but it is increasing our bills by a lot. And when it comes down to prudent and reasonable, it's interesting, right? The legislature sets these requirements, but those aren't having to be prudent and reasonable, but we won't go there. So now we've got these regulations. One of the things that you talked to me about yesterday was kind of interesting that I wanted to let folks know. You talked about the Great Compact, right? This compact in the 1920s that happened out of Chicago that got us to this natural monopoly scenario, which I found interesting. Can you explain a little about that?
Sure, I'll try. About the turn of the century, about 1890, early 1890s, Thomas Edison's private secretary, Sammy Insull, gentleman came over from London with a few dollars in his hand. He went right to Edison, got a job with him, and was very capable, and he and Edison got along fantastically.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, when Edison lost the control of General Edison Electric and became General Electric, Insull took a job in Chicago at Edison Electric in Chicago. And he started buying up what at the time were central stations. Central stations were powered by coal. They powered generators that created DC current, direct current.
Yeah.
And direct current had a drawback. It could only go about a mile before it had what's called load loss.
Mm-hmm.
So the voltage dropped significantly. He found a way to consolidate the stations, turn to AC power, which is more efficient, could run over lines, began reducing the cost of power and increasing. And when he did that, he could lower prices, and consequently, he could spread the cost over a larger group of people.
Mm-hmm.
But in the competition area, the more the competition was, the more there was competition, you were creating two similar systems doing the same exact thing, and consequently, the prices were going to be higher. So the compact was between private industry and government.
Mm-hmm.
And private industry would give up unlimited profits, so to speak, and the government would be the ones to set the rates. And they would set the rates at a level that was, again, reasonable, where the utilities had the opportunity, but not a guarantee, to recover their costs and earn a modest profit on behalf of their investors.
Right.
So that happened in the early 1900s, I want to say 19-teens, or just after the war.
And so when people think about Eversource, we only have one competitor because of that original idea back in Chicago, where they said, you know what, this competition thing, it's not working out for us. It's too much work. Let's let the government regulate us so that we don't have to compete with each other, and we'll make whatever that modest, reasonable competition profit is. But so this is the kind of thing, is when you wonder about why there's no competition, it's because 100 plus years ago, those guys said, that, you know what, this is what we're going to do. 100 years later, we're still doing it, right, Michael? Same basic thing.
Yeah. And Insull proved that by regulating the rates, you would have a more stable and least cost of operation and finding efficiencies versus what was done in the old model, because it was the capital investment up front was becoming prohibitive, and those fixed costs.
Right.
So it didn't matter how much, because there's so many users or ratepayers that didn't use a lot of energy.
Yep.
So you're losing money on all of them. But if you get the larger users, more customers on the larger side, they would help subsidize the low use ratepayers.
And that all made sense.
You get a more efficient price.
Yeah, that might have all made sense back in 1920.
Right, and you also don't have the overall economy paying for duplication of infrastructure, because you don't have three or four different electrical utilities providing service with three or four different cabling, setups and all of that.
Poles.
Poles duplicated. Yeah, you don't have that. So the economy isn't bolstering that. And it does provide some savings over time.
But what happened?
Then you have the bill to be paid later, which we're paying now.
But something's gone wrong now, considering if you have all else being equal and that method is the same. And what happens is with this green energy concept, which is fine. Clean energy is fine by me. But if it costs five or six times what it would cost for the standard energy, there's a problem here, in that what's reasonable is clearly not reasonable here in Connecticut. That's just me. But that's how we got here. So that old 1920s pact, where they agreed to monopoly, PURA is involved in trying to make sure that it's reasonable and is prudent. And then the legislature, who doesn't have to be reasonable nor prudent or even understand math or economics in any way, shape, or form, is the one setting the requirements for you as a PURA member to actually do all this processing. We got to take a quick break, Michael. Can you hang on for a few more minutes?
Certainly.
All right. We're talking with Michael Caron, former commissioner of PURA, about how the electricity works. We'll be right back. All right. And we are back. And we're lucky enough to have Michael Caron joining us from a former member of PURA, talking about electricity, how reasonable and prudency is what we're supposed to be having. Right, Michael?
Well, the way we put it is we're trying to develop safe, reliable power for the least cost.
Right. Now, we talked about a big bill coming due. And I actually saw this in the Harvard Business Journal recently. There's some storm damage cost that has been kicked the can down the line there, that is in the billions, that we're paying like $8 million a month in carrying costs by not paying this bill. I mean, it just sounded horrible. What is going on with this future bill that we're all about to be whacked with?
So after a storm, certainly after a major storm, utilities, again, they pre-stage before the storm gets here. They hire utility workers from other states for mutual aid and incur costs.
Mm-hmm.
And if those aren't paid in a relatively short time, they accrue and they grow and grow. And by the way, more storms tend to come on top of them. So at this point, the authority is currently dealing with a docket that has, I think it's in the nature, the range of about 14 large or major storms that we paid for
14?
EverSource.
We waited this long to pay for 14 storms, for crying out loud. We got one coming tomorrow.
Indeed. And the cost is, or projected cost is about $1.6 billion.
Nothing reasonable and prudent about that.
Well, it is if your lights come back on at a reasonable time.
No, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But paying the bill is reasonable and prudent, not paying it.
Paying the bill is going to be tough. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
One of my first dockets that I did when I started was a storm cost recovery for the October nor'easter.
Yeah. But that was in 2015.
That was
2011 or 2012.
Okay.
So it was 2010. I got there in 2012, so that's when we did that docket.
Yeah.
And again, they have to show that the costs incurred were prudent. They were reasonably done by a reasonable person. And it was effective. And then they're allowed to recover those costs. And so what we did at that time is there was a bit of a surcharge on the bill. And I think we made it for over the course of 6 years. So those storm costs have taken over 6 years. What we're hearing now for this, mega storm recovery docket is probably securitizing the money owed to the utilities at a lower rate than the current carrying charges, and could be anywhere from, like I said, I did 6 years, anywhere up to 20 years. So people could be paying for these storm costs for literally decades. And again, there are a few more storms out there that are not included in this particular docket, which I think will be taken care of in an EverSource rate case you can expect either mid-year or at the end of 2026.
Well, I'm gonna butt in here again and ask about that word securitization.
Yeah.
And also I'm gonna point out that how much more are we going to end up having to pay for these storms, not just for the costs of the repairs, which are necessary, but the debt service, because we've been sitting on the bill for how many years?
Right. 14 storms worth.
And we have to finance that.
Right.
So how much more are we paying because of that, and how does securitization work into this? That's my question.
Well, if by securitizing it, the theory is that the carry cost will be lower than if you did it over a short time on the ratepayer bill.
Okay.
Directly.
All right. So it's
a way of reducing the cost over time per bill one gets, that a ratepayer gets.
All right. So that's a way of managing the debt. Okay, that makes sense.
And managing the payment for the ratepayers, we're going to have to ultimately pay the bill for fixing the system.
Yeah.
But it was the one of the reasons that it's grown this much is our previous chair thought it was leverage to try and get the utilities, who had their $1 billion hanging out there, to come in sooner for a rate case. And she was very interested in having them come in and doing some of the things that she had done previously with other rate cases, where she really thought she could lower rates. And while she did in a couple of instances, the courts have since found that those dockets are what they call tainted and are going to be remanded back to the authority for re-adjudication. And consequently, it didn't save the ratepayers anything. In fact, it pushed the costs out further and further, and they're going to be paying for them more and more.
So Michael, on that concept there, that delay is going to cause more costs because we didn't take care of the bill in the first place. And again,
absolutely right.
So that as a regulating agency, I would think the legislature would say, we have to pay our bills. I mean, I got to pay my bills in 30 days. I'm a you, Dennis.
Yeah, same here.
Why would we not have that requirement statutorily if, again, the legislature in its infinite wisdom says we're supposed to pay for generation that costs 5, 6, 7 times what natural gas would cost? They should at least say, when we owe a bill, pay it in this amount of time. I know we do these weird mathematical things here, but to get in these types of holes seems like just bad management by both the legislature and, of course, the chair that caused this issue in the first place. It shouldn't be a thing. I mean, my point is, it shouldn't be a thing. if reasonable and prudent is everything you've talked about, how do we get in this hole? I mean, I don't blame you. I blame the legislature who puts us in these predicaments, whereas we're going to have to write this check. We're all going to have to write, and our bills are already unaffordable. So what are we looking at? Is it like a tsunami of costs we're looking at? I mean, I can't imagine our bills going up higher.
I think it started with good intentions, and it was an experiment in what was called activist regulation that just really has been a failure, and that's what we're seeing. But you couldn't see it at the time. It's one of those things that kind of grow on you. Next thing you know, I think you mentioned frog boiling in water.
Yes.
All of a sudden, hey, I'm boiling. What's going
on? We're boiling, Michael.
And that's kind of what we've seen. So right. In terms of the legislature, there are statutes that require utilities to come in every 4 years, unless there's an agreement amongst various parties that they'll stay out. Yeah. In fact, the Office of Consumer Counsel and the Attorney General, when they do negotiations on sometimes rate cases, they come to a compromise, they often encourage longer stayouts. And that's what's happened with electric Eversource. There was a previous settlement with AG, OCC, ultimately approved by the authority.
Yep.
They had them staying out until about this year.
Well, Michael, we're coming up against a hard break. We appreciate you joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
And we want to have you back, okay, sir?
Sure. I'd be happy to.
All right. Michael Caron, former.
We'll break this down further.
Very good. Former commissioner of PIRA. We'll be right back.
What's up, little psychos? I'm Investigator Slater, host of the Psychopedia podcast. Psychopedia is a true crime podcast delivering raw, real, and absolutely gripping episodes every single week. I dig deep to uncover fascinating details of heinous true crime cases while exploring criminology and psychology theories. I take you into the absolute darkest corners of the human psyche, my favorite territory, and present cases like you've never heard them before. Follow and listen to Psychopedia everywhere you get your podcasts.
All right. We are back. And it was great to have Michael Caron on. He only had 30 minutes, so I know it seemed like he got a lot in 30 minutes to kind of explain how that electricity sausage was made. And we appreciate his time. We'll have him on again to talk about electricity. But the thing about it that I found it so interesting, and he told me about it yesterday, and I didn't know this, is, again, that 1920s compact between the robber barons of electricity at the time, take it for whatever it is. And I appreciate the concept and the theory that maybe this is, quote unquote, the cheapest way to do it. But based on our electricity bills, I would contend it's not anymore. Something is wrong. And maybe it was back then. But if I could get together with all the bakeries out there and say, let's just make one bakery factory and we'll just have the government regulate our bread and we'll make 10% on our bread and nobody will compete with us and it'll be just a happy-go-lucky. Do you think your bread's going to be good or do you think your bread's going to be okay? And I would contend it's just going to be okay because of a guaranteed monopoly like this. What's reasonable? I don't know. Is moldy bread reasonable? Is only having one type of bread reasonable? I would contend our electric bills are obviously not reasonable or prudent. And to not pay the bill for 14 storms.
That's crazy. That's insane.
It is. But that's...
Even though we securitized it.
Well, that's the plan. We're going to consider securitizing it because right now that hasn't been come up with yet from what I understand. In the Hartford Business Journal article, we're paying $8 million a month on the carrying costs of not paying this. And that's carrying costs being charged by the utility, which who makes that number up? they can say whatever they want as far as that carrying cost.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a big mess, obviously, and having Michael talk about it. Again, PIRA is in the middle of it. We can love them, we can hate them, but they're doing what the legislator told them to do.
Right.
They're the ones that put these statutes in place that say you have to have 18% of this or that type of energy. So you are paying a premium for that. To what benefit? I'll leave it up to you. We'll be here taking your calls till 11 o'clock. Mark in Barkhamsted's been on the line. What's going on, Mark? Mark, you there?
Hi.
All right.
Sorry about that.
No, we're sorry. You've been on for half an hour.
Yeah, I had a few topics. First of all, the call you guys had about Microsoft OneDrive and how it tends to back up everything when it can.
Yeah.
By default, it should only be backing up stuff on your desktop, documents, or pictures, and that includes subdirectories.
Yes.
That is true, yeah.
That's the default.
In multiple places, it assumes you're the same person. It tries to sync everything up. It's kind of annoying.
Correct.
I mean, the only thing on that is to have a different Microsoft account for every machine. The guy about upgrading his PC, if it's 5 years old, that's probably a good bet. Historically, TPM 2.0 came out in 2014.
Yeah, yes.
But, you know, TPM 1.2 was around that didn't have much traction. Manufacturers weren't building into the BIOS very well, so especially the cheaper machines, even if it was there, it was never on by default. But it wasn't until Windows 11 came out in 21 that all of a sudden, you know, TPM 2.0 was a big deal.
Yeah.
A lot of other manufacturers posting stuff about, you have to enable TPM now. Sorry, you didn't have to before. You need secure boot. You need this and that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We actually have some computers that clients at TAB bought about 4 years ago, like 22, that had TPM 2.0 on board, and Windows 11 had been released at that time.
Yep.
But these computers were sold to them with Windows 10 on them and with the TPM disabled in BIOS.
Right.
And this was in 2022 when the manufacturer knew what the requirements were. They knew what should be sold. They knew what should be coming off that assembly line, and they sold an obsolete operating system with the TPM disabled that should not have happened according to their contract with Microsoft at the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how bad it was.
Because
the manufacturers are kind of sly. A lot of times had a XPS, top-of-the-line laptop. You bought it seventh generation, right? One generation shy of the Windows 11 upgrade, but it had a M2.0 module in the BIOS that I could enable. So I just used the bypass to do the Windows 11 upgrade, but technically on paper, except for the 7th generation Intel, it runs fine.
Well, you know, it should.
Yeah, it should.
Yeah. Nothing special about the 8th generation chipset or instruction set that would warrant it. It's just they drew a line in the sand, and it was 8th generation Intel and AMD 300.
Right.
That was that.
They got in a room, and they decided, here's what we're going to do, and they all agreed to it, and they slapped each other's backs, and then we're paying for the upgrades.
The guy with the five-year-old machine is probably okay. I would say if you have an AMD, it may not be as Sherlock as Intel, because AMD tends to lag about a year or two on the chipset stuff.
Yep.
It's just, you know, that's just the way it is. I sent you guys an email, and I heard you talk about this. I figured I'd give you a call about the memory.
Yeah.
This NAND and all, and Dennis has said, you know, it's probably going to settle down after the first quarter or so.
That's what I think, yeah.
I don't think so. I think there's a lot of press out there trying to make it kind of rose-colored, you know, looking at it in a very, you know, NAND product, they get updated every 3 months or so, usually on supply demand. And what I'm seeing is the people that are a little more pragmatic and look at the reality say that they figure that you're going to have issues from 2026 into 2027. And the prices will probably rise through the first 6 months, potentially stabilizing this summer. But stabilizing just means a higher price. And that 2026 is just going to be an abysmal year for buying anything that's NAND-based. That includes graphics cards, memory, SSDs, you know.
Yeah.
And everything else is falling apart because, like, DDR5 got expensive. Well, now DDR4 is getting popular. I think NVIDIA is going to stop manufacturing some of their GeForce 5060 cards because they don't want to put 16 gig of GDDR7 memory in. You know, it's trying to save money.
Yeah.
But just for a final note, I'm just kind of pontificating here and not asking a question.
No, you're welcome. So, Mark, your opinion is welcome. Yeah. We've been through, I mean, I've done this for 36 years at TAB, and I've seen so many cycles building machines. Whether it be shortages and hard drive RAM, so your feeling on it is as good as anybody's, right?
Well, yeah, and there are people that are you know, projecting some severe fallout lasting into 27, like he was talking about.
Yeah, so you're right. Maybe companies are not going to buy because they can't. I mean, during COVID, you couldn't even get a laptop.
Well, I think they're following the benchmarks. They're following the money because, you know, the manufacturer build DDR5 memory. The same fabs can build the HBM memory for the AI servers.
Yeah.
And like twice the return on the HBM memory. So they have a choice to build DDR5.
I agree.
They just don't have capacity because they build the plants like in a 5-year, 10-year projection out. So it's a big deal. It's billions of dollars. Nobody anticipated this. So we're basically victims of supply and demand.
Correct. But I would contend that there's plenty of alternative manufacturing that's out there saying, absolutely, wait a minute, there's an opportunity.
It takes time to grow up. That's why I'm saying that chances are 6 months of misery. But anyway, just for a final little fact that I thought was interesting, it's a 246% price increase on basically your SSDs from the first quarter of 2025 to the first quarter of 2026.
Yep.
And the best number I could find is that they expect 50% price increase in the first 6 months of this year. So that would give you some. So, I don't know if the math is exactly right, but close to 300% uptick.
It's going to be crazy. It's going to be a slow upgrade year because no one's going to pay those prices.
I have like a half dozen PCs I built on speculation this year just because I'm a geek and I like to build PCs.
Yeah.
Memory in the PCs is worth more than what I paid for all the parts to put them together.
I know. That is.
Yeah. Thanks for putting up with me, guys. I appreciate it.
Oh, no.
No, you're welcome. You're welcome, Mark. Anytime, please. Yeah.
Thanks for chiming in, man.
Yeah.
All right. So Mark from Barkhamsted, he's definitely got some insights on what's going on with the technology.
Yeah.
Let's go to Tim in Harwington next. What's going on, Tim?
Hi, guys. I have a nonprofit machine. It has Windows 10, and I'm trying to upgrade it to 11. It's kind of a follow-up from your first call.
Sure.
I turned the TPM on. It looks like it's turned on to 2.0. But then when it goes to install, it says, and have you run across this, that it's not a dual-core processor?
Hmm. So it's an older, it most likely is an older flavor.
What is the CPU?
All right, I'm looking at it right now. An Intel Core i7-7560U 240 gigahertz. Does that sound, it just seems like it's a newer machine to me, but.
So it's not officially supported. It's seventh gen.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. No workie for you.
It does have multiple cores, but it's just not being detected as a supported CPU. So that's probably what the error is throwing.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it doesn't mean that the CPU doesn't have the cores.
No.
It's just kind of a misidentification of what's wrong.
So here's what you can do, Tim. You can pay for the ESU. If you want to make sure your machine is at least getting security updates for Windows 10. You can pay for the extended support updates. And I think it's $30 for the year for home users. And you keep running Windows 10. And no harm, no foul. The only problem will be software that says it must run on Windows 11 won't run.
Right. So if it's I think we have some deal with Microsoft because it's a nonprofit, but I don't know if they'll give us a break. But
on what?
On the machine, because we have 365 and all that stuff.
Oh, they don't care. They don't care.
Yeah.
If it's a nonprofit, though, you should be able to get ESU pricing on the nonprofit upgrade. I can tell you the commercial pricing for ESU per workstation is $61 a year, maybe $62. But I would think the nonprofit pricing will be a fraction of that, I hope.
Yeah, it'll be less than that. It might be somewhere in the neighborhood of the consumer price, which is $39.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So go ahead and do that. And as long as the software you're using isn't going to force you to make the upgrade to 11, you're good.
Yeah, I think the only thing would be a 365 hit me in the butt, you know what I mean?
Well, 365 is just the suite. It really isn't the operating system. So it really, if that's all you're running on it, though, you should be fine. It'll run on Windows 10.
Yeah, so to your point, Microsoft could do something crazy. But, so you said the ESU?
Yep. It's a Win 10 ESU that'll extend the updates, which means you'll stay compliant per se. You'll be able to keep your security levels at least, and you'll be keeping your machines protected from Microsoft.
All right.
That's all you're doing is paying for security updates of the fixes they have to do on their software.
All right. Okay.
All right.
I just thought I was in trouble, but but yeah, as you confirm.
Yeah, seventh gen. Right. Seventh gen, Tim. Sorry.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
You got it, sir.
Yeah, bye.
Bye. And that's a nice machine. i7, seventh gen, multi-core.
Yeah, I would think that it would be very happy with Windows 11, but I guess that it's not.
You could go to the moon on it in 1970. So we're going to be here till 11 o'clock, coming in the final stretch, four lines wide open if you want to get a question in before the snowmageddon. 860-522-9842 is the number. We'll do our best to answer your question. Everything we talked about over at computertalkwithtab.com. If you want to listen to the program, if you missed anything, of course, the Odyssey app. You can follow us on the Odyssey app, or if you're on Spotify or anywhere you get a podcast, you can subscribe to our podcasts. And you'll get the information that way. We're very happy to have Michael Caron on from Pura talking a little bit about how electricity was made. So if you missed that interview, it's there for you. It'll be available and you can take a listen to it. And that's the whole idea. I mean, podcasting has been around since the original Apple iPod, which is now 20 years old at least.
Hey, what's up, flies? This is David Spade.
Dana Carvey.
Look, I know we never actually left, but I'll just say it. We are back with another season of Fly on the Wall.
Every episode, including ones with guests, will now be on video. Every Thursday, you'll hear us and see us chatting with big-name celebrities.
And every Monday, you're stuck with just me and Dana. We react to news, what's trending, viral clips.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
25 maybe. It might have come out in 2000. I don't know.
It goes back a ways.
Yeah.
And so every show is podcasted. So you can go ahead. We've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of Computer Talk with Tab.
They first came out in 01.
Really?
So yeah, they are going on 25 years old.
25 years old. And podcasting back then was like, what the heck's that? So we're going to step out for a quick break and get back to your calls. This is Computer Talk. You guys are all calling. I appreciate it. But we only have like 10 minutes left. So we're going to go to Scott and Weetog next. Hey, Scott.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've been downloading photographs to my hard drive or through my hard drive to an external drive. And every now and then my hard drive says it's full. It's a 500 gigabyte. It'll say that it's reading at 500 gigabyte, and all of a sudden it'll go back to about 300.
Ooh.
That's good behavior?
No, that's not good behavior. That's bad behavior. That means there's something maybe physically wrong with that drive's geometry.
Yeah, that's telling me there might be some kind of controller failure.
Oh, boy.
Yep.
I was kind of thinking you'd say that. It's about a four-year-old machine, and I thought I had adequate size, but it's, I don't know the exact dynamics of it, but obviously it feeds through the computer into the external hard drive. But every now and then it just, you know, gets backlogged and stops and tells me there's challenges. And then I'll go back a while later, and sure enough, it's at 250 or 300 gigabytes.
Yeah. So I would tell you that thing's probably failing. You want to back it up if you can. Any data on there might be questionable.
Most of the data is on the external drive, and I'm actually doing Backblaze this weekend. That's one of my goals, but I wanted to talk to you guys about that too.
Yeah, we think it's failing.
I would be trying to replace that drive.
Don't run a check disk yet.
Right. Don't do that because that can make it worse. I'm assuming this is an SSD, right?
No, it's a spinning drive.
All right, well.
Still don't do it.
I still wouldn't do the check disk, but the danger level is not what we're, you know, is not there.
Okay.
Because with an SSD and you run check disk, if anything doesn't get reconstituted correctly, then poof, it's gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
With at least a magnetic drive, the magnetic image would remain behind for anything that gets overwritten, but then you have to figure out how to recover it, which is a different story. But at any rate, you don't want to go there, is what I'm saying.
Back it up, put it aside, it's failing.
Yep.
Oh, boy. So would you recommend an upgraded SSD inside the box or just get a whole new?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
At this point, inside of a computer, you always want an SSD.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Zumba. Oh, yeah.
It'll be fast, and it won't have to go through USB like it is now.
And if you want to have a secondary drive with large storage and maybe make that magnetic, okay. But I would not make my main drive or boot drive a magnetic drive anymore.
Spinny.
Yeah, you don't want that.
Okay.
All right.
I'll let you take more callers. Thank you, and I'll keep listening.
Sounds good, Scott. Good luck.
Talk soon.
All right, bye-bye. Let's go on to Michael in Canton. What's happening, Michael?
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
Hope you're ready for the storm. I had a quick question for you guys on Gmail, and then I really like Outlook, but is it for security reasons, you know, to change it over from Gmail and then, you know, I don't know, find some way to go to Outlook? Wouldn't it be better just to go directly and get an Outlook email address instead of having kind of an intermediary?
Well, these are mail clients. So Gmail's a mail client. You're talking about an Outlook's a mail client, but your mailbox is what? Where are you getting your mail from?
Well, I get it. I primarily use Gmail. I just like Outlook as a way to organize it.
Well, right. Yes.
Gmail's not very good.
You can continue doing that. Outlook is a fine mail client, and it will connect with the Gmail account and show it to you.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, you can keep doing that.
Okay. I just thought there was, like, you know, security issues when you're, you know, using a Gmail, which is so popular, and trying to find a way to make it less hackable, I guess.
Well, yeah. But, okay. Well, yeah. So we talk about Proton and other mail systems you pay for versus the Gmail system.
Yeah.
If you have two-factor running on your Gmail account, it's more secure.
You have that. Yeah, we're doing that.
That's good. But yeah, the mail system, Gmail, Hotmail, any of these quote unquote free mail systems, I would contend are less secure than if you paid for a Proton, which is encrypted end to end. Right. So if you really want security, that'll do it.
When you use Gmail for so long, everyone knows your Gmail account. How do you change it so that people know you have a new email address, I guess?
You have to tell them and hope that they start using the new address.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
Yeah, and basically it's a little tag you put in all your emails. Please note that our new email address is.
As a matter of fact, he can configure Outlook.
Yeah,
Using that to connect to the Gmail, he can configure his reply to address to be the new address, whatever it is, for that mailbox. And then when people reply to him, it's going to go to the new place.
They're forced to it. They don't even have to know
what's
happening.
Unless they actually look at what they're doing and where the mail is going, it's just going to naturally go to you. You would just set the reply to address in the Outlook client.
Now, with Proton, if you do go to that mail system, you can use Outlook, but you have to configure an intermediary tool to allow that to work. So it's not as intuitive, but it does work with this intermediary. I can't think of what it's called right now, but it's a file. It's an email interface between Proton and Outlook to make that work. So it's wherever your mail is that's the security issue, not your client.
Right, and that's right. Okay. Yeah, it's just Gmail is so popular and we've used it for so long, but it's like it's trying to get a better system. And Gmail's layout is not that great, I don't find.
So. Yeah, I would agree with that. But your Proton can be a little funky, too, as far as how it lays things out. So, you know, you're going to deal with all these different scenarios. But having your box paid for, that mailbox paid for, at least gives you some level of security you don't have now.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You got it, Michael. Good luck.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. I did see that Gmail is allowing you to change your email name, your actual email address, because who knows what you created when you were in middle school and you've got the ladies' man email address that Wiki had, right? So you could change your email address to something new. I guess they're playing with it. They started it in
India.
Thank you. And now they've released it. It seems everywhere. Slowly, you should be able to make that change to a different address at least, which is kind of handy. Anything you want to bring up there, Dennis, before we come up to the top of the hour and get ready to get our milk and bread?
Yeah. Microsoft has been putting ads up when you, let's say you get a new computer.
Yeah.
You bought the new computer. You want to get Chrome on it, right?
Yeah.
So what do? You open Edge, which is Microsoft product,
mm-hmm.
go to Google or search for Google Chrome.
I've seen this.
And it's going to tell you, don't do that. Use Edge instead, right?
Right.
Well, it turns out that Microsoft had an ad, one of these ads that they put in Bing, and it accidentally directed people to the Chrome installer.
That's pretty funny.
So they're trying to tell you not to use it, but then they point you right to it. And then when this got mentioned in social media or other settings, they finally edited the ad. Didn't do that again.
Yeah. See, that shouldn't be a thing, right? It shouldn't be a thing that the software you buy... is telling you, don't go here. You shouldn't go here.
If I want to run Chrome, I want to run Chrome.
Leave me alone. Run Chrome. Exactly. All right. Well, there's that. That's the way to end the program. I want to thank Mike G for posting everything over on our Facebook page and over on X. Thank Carolyn for producing. Thank you for coming in. And she's all set for the storm, I'm sure. but we want to thank you guys. You guys really make this show happen. We also want to thank Michael Caron, too. Pura Commissioner we'll have on more often as well to kind of understand how the sausage is made. So when you're wondering why your electricity rates are as high as they are, yes, Pura is involved, but they're following the statutes set forth by your elected officials. Thank them. So we'll see you guys next Saturday.
Do you have a dark curiosity? Follow and listen to Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.